Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Kevin Boyler, your host at Epis Radio. It is July 7th. It's July 7th, 2020. And here we are again, continuing our discussion about the general state of things in the world. So we're still finding our way to a summer topic of interest, and until then, we're going to continue our basic radio conversation with me on Nazarita Goldhammer, if she does find her way into the studio today. So one of the things I'd like to just throw out there is this idea of transcendental closure. Now, transcendental closure means that our ability to see new possibilities for ourselves and for the world is constricted. It's closed. So you can imagine that people become so, presenced with a certain kind of self, an occupation, a set of roles with family, something like that, that they're basically instrumentalizing everything. Everything is either useful or it's not useful. And unfortunately, that level of thinking penetrate into a deeper understanding, a wisdom of how we're living in the first place. It's a very problematic state we're in to interpret in terms of use and instrumental value. We're not saying that it's inherently bad. It's just that it's so completely out of balance with other forms of thinking, one of them being the seeking of meaning, the seeking of understanding. And we don't seem to be doing very much of that in the Western world these days. Now, that's not true for everybody. But it is true in kind, as a general observation. We're under threat. Freedom is under threat. Health is under threat. People's ability to survive is under threat. Folks have sedimented ways of life that they've grown accustomed to, even whether they're good or bad or otherwise, no matter what their value is. So we're in a major change. Now, some people have a super hard time with change. These are people who psychologically are very attached to life as they know it. So they don't really understand living in the ontological foundation. They don't understand that what goes into everything you think and do comes from a subjectivity that is constituted by a noetic structure that in part was given through your facticity, things that you can never change about yourself, and then through your freedom, which are elements that you can change. The transcendent or transcendental subjectivity means this faculty that we have to see possibilities. And I'm not talking about possibilities like what time I go to the store for dinner, or what time I prepare dinner, when I go to the gym, when I go into work, or what I'm going to do this weekend. Those are very superficial, ontic decisions that have little to nothing to do with what I'm talking about. A transcendental structure means bracketing everything you think you are, bracketing your personal identity, bracketing your attachments, bracketing your way in the world, bracketing the way you think the world works, bracketing who you think you are, bracketing your sociality. Instead of just making blind assumptions about the value of your life and what you do, it means to bracket everything and rethink. Well, it's a gift that we have. It's a gift, and unfortunately, we've gotten into this status in the world in which all kinds of fancy reasons why they can't make changes. And you can see the strategy in the way they talk, the way they argue, the way they reason. It's all instrumentalized. It's very utilitarian. Utilitarianism is, I think, a very outmoded and dangerous approach to moral thinking and to anthropological thinking. It becomes subsumed under commodification, governmentalization, capitalisms of all kinds. And some people can be very good at it. So for example, some young people are taught calculus, an advanced calculus, which measures change. And they value this sort of learning, but it comes from a certain kind of thinking, a basic posture in the world. And so not all mathematics is valuable. Mathematics is not just mathematics. These are cognitive constructions that do things. They're performatives. They are expressions of our anthropology. So when I mention transcendental structures or transcendental subjectivity or the transcendent possibilities, I truly mean opening up our thinking to a different kind of way, or the release of these ontic instrumentalizations to penetrate into what we call in Europe the Verstehen philosophy of meaning, the philosophy of understanding. Like, who are we? What are we doing? What is the meaning of what we're doing? So I'm going to open up the conversation right there. I've got Nazarita Goldhammer on the line here in the digital studio. And really, what we've been trying to do is cultivate a general conversation about how we have a closure or really strong forces to close thinking in the world, closing creative thinking, closing innovation, closing all kinds of thinking that do not trigger profit, GDP, efficiency, increased revenues, that sort of utilitarian thinking, which is a very limited mind space. So Nazarita, are you on the show?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Fantastic. Here we are again, Epis Radio, the year 2020. We're in our seventh year, unbelievable as it is. So what do you think about everything that you're sensing and seeing and hearing digitally across the world about these closures in critical thinking and closures in creative thinking? What are you sensing?
Well, what you started with today was really triggered me. It was really interesting because in the past, there were groups of people that really sought like a higher consciousness. There were always little groups of people, you know, monks, nuns, however they were put. Usually they were in some religious context away from, you know, normal civilization. And I was thinking that because I was reading a book on ancient Tibet, the way Tibet used to be, and how it was a city of hardship. Like, you had to be really strong to live there. And because of the conditions, it could be really hot in the daytime and get really freezing at night. The winds were brutal, and they had to have food that really sustained them. So I was thinking of this in regards to what you were saying, is that we have a closure now because more and more people are not striving to think more clearly, to seek the transcendent, to become more aware. They're being closed off little by little, or maybe not little by little, but in great leaps and bounds. And so I've recently been obsessed ever since the movie The Cleaners came out, because I want to see it, how people scrub the internet, and that there's hundreds and hundreds of places filled with thousands of workers that go through everything on the internet before anyone sees it. Before you open up your iPad, your iPhone, your computer, take a look on Facebook, any social media, that all the things that are really violent and disturbing are taken off. And I'm not talking about fake political messages. I'm talking about really extreme violence. Even though some gets through, all they need hundreds of thousands of people to scrub the internet. And so I was thinking of that in terms of what you were just talking about, that here we are in a time where people, it seems, are more closed-minded, except for small groups that are trying to really do well in the world, to integrate nature and the other, and to think differently. And yet, what's being hidden from us, kind of like a Matrix-like scenario, is that we're prevented from seeing the real. And I thought of this in regards to Tibet, because since it is a harsh climate, I thought people didn't try to make it better. They said, this is the real. Live here. This is what you have to endure. And part of that endurance of the real opens up a different kind of consciousness, because you're not always seeking in your environment to discern what is real, what is built, how can you get out, how can you have more freedom. A lot of our time, I believe, is spent in this kind of thinking, like we're boxed in. We're boxed in by rules, regulations, laws, you know, people with wealth wanting to control those without wealth, you know, poverty, you know, all the things that we've talked about, sexism and racism, and those things are consuming our mind. They're like it's like a fantasy world, even though it's not fantasy, but it prevents us from seeing what is real. It prevents us from taking action, because we're consumed with how do we get more money, how do we pay our rent, and there's so many things that are wrong with our world, that in this striving of the wheel just to make a living, right? It's interesting, those words, make a living. We're not really living. What we're doing is we're trying to sustain the way to change. So I really responded to what you were saying about seeking something different, to see the real, to experience more of the transcendent thinking. And how do we do that? And it's by becoming aware of our surroundings, of what is real and what is not, you know. So those were just some of my thoughts. And of course, they zigzagged all over, really, the world, thinking, how are we in bondage to this consciousness that is concerned with that which is not real? Here's another, my last thought on it. You know, Trump, who is a bombastic fool, wanting to have a hero's garden. Now, in effect, that is not a bad thing, but I'm thinking, who are our real heroes now? We don't have anyone that we strive to be like. You know, there isn't anyone that exemplifies virtue or humility or, you know, the good, or as we perceive the good. It's more about who has the most money, who has the most money and can control the most. That's who people aspire to be like, whether it's a sports star, you know, that can use their natural abilities and their honed abilities to make money. If they didn't make money, would we still have the same hero worship? You know, actors and actresses who have a lot of money, where do they live? They live in exclusive places. They spend their money on more and more, you know, more and more bigger places. So anyway, what is real? What is a hero? What is a transcendent consciousness in this world today? And why are we being hidden from this? Like, why are we not seeking that? So thank you for inspiring that, because that's a really real question.
Yeah, okay. So you said a lot there. I'm gonna respond to three elements that you just mentioned. One, the real. Two, virtue and models. And three, commodification. So let's talk about the real. The real means the reality principle. That deep, complex kernel of algorithmic structures in the ontological framing of the world, of being, that determine at the very bottom of the pond what appears and presences as reality in a particular culture. And we have choice in that. It's not something that's just foisted upon us other than nature. Nature is what it is. It does what it does. And we can either respect it and work within it, or we can fight against it. So right now we have a reality principle that is largely based on narcissism. It's shameful how we value in this country. We value perfumes and pretty clothes and Botox injections and a lot of things that a lot of activities that are not just health inducing, they're not salubrious in themselves, but they create the appearance. And so part of the reality principle right now is cloaked in nihilism, which is destruction. It's cloaked in deception, both self-deception and massification of deception, sometimes called cultural deception. So the reality principle is based upon a way of positioning oneself in the world. And our deep way, which is something I've been thinking about ever since I started thinking about these things as a teenager, is a really important question. How, at the very root of things, are we posturing ourselves in the world? How do we deal with anxiety? How do I approach all living creatures? How do I approach the other? What do I eat? What's my schedule? What are my main goals in life? Who do I follow? Who do I read? And that takes us to your notion of heroes, virtue, and models. So Aristotle started in the Western world a system of ethics called Aretaic ethics. And this means to pick your teachers wisely. If you pick the wrong teacher, you're in big trouble. But if you pick your models of excellence really carefully and you follow that model of excellence, eventually you'll surpass your teacher. Eventually you'll surpass your master. What a great thank you. What a great generosity to the master as you surpass the master. That means you chose well. And right now, what we take to be models of virtue in this country largely revolves around money. Very, in my opinion, very distorted and deceptive ideas of eros and beauty. What is not counted so much anymore is the set of virtuous behaviors and values, conscientiousness, humility, modesty, compassion, empathy, elements like that that often don't get you any money, right? They often don't get you to the top of the food chain in a capitalist system. So, we're, in my opinion, we've chosen a kind of false aretaic ethics. False. It's just not. It's not true. It's. It's completely distorted. So, for example, if I choose Jeff Bezos as a model, or Donald Trump, I'm making a big error. Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, I don't see any virtue in these people at all. Zero. I see people who are have bloodlust for more and more and more. And so the question is, how do we pick our models? How do we pick our masters? Who do we read? What you read is incredibly important. You can't read it all. And you have to be, some people will talk about, you know, I read everything. They'll say, they'll talk about being, you know, erudite and well-read. There's a certain deception in that as well. It is critical to be really choosy about what you read, what is in your library, and what you should get out of your library right away. Again, who you pick as a master is critical. And then the third element is commodification. So commodification creates its own value structure that subjugates and suppresses all other values. So all these other values that we could come up with, that even good people could come up with, put them on the table, say these are the values of a good civilization, they become swept away and dissipated in a capitalist commodification structure, because they're always reinterpreted in terms of commodification. You know, what is its use value? How much is it going to produce? How efficient is it? What is it going to get me? And a lot of people are blind to the poison of this way of thinking. This way of thinking has created modern physics. There are people who are physicists who don't even understand what they're doing, because it comes from a certain kind of choice about being structure, certain ontology, a certain topological structure. The modern math that fuels physics came from this sort of thinking, perfecting the world, instrumentalizing the other, taking, commodifying, building, growing, accumulating, possessing, acquiring, measuring, quantifying. It's all the same thing. And very few people who are doing these things, living in this way, would ever think to step back and use their God-given intelligence and critically review their way in the world. We have great professional practitioners of all kinds, and all kinds of professions, who are part of this great big commodification wheel. And what they do is they pick out pieces or fragments in what they do. They say, see, I'm doing a good thing. Look, I'm helping others. I'm serving others. When in reality, you're serving the beast. So that's my response to year three, Nazarita.
Yeah. So when you really look at the world, it's like this mass cover-up. Right, for the lack of a kind of a better world, it's like everybody is playing in this theater where there is this pretend cover up of value. Everybody is participating, and to break out of that is really difficult. I mean, it's really difficult for people to change. And you and I did something a while ago that was really important. Is We know that we came up in the science that where you live, if you live close to a slaughterhouse or rendering plant, that there is more violence manifested physically, but also in your thinking emotions. And then when we looked at a world map, we realized that slaughterhouses and rendering plants were everywhere. And so this feeds directly into the concept that the world is a very violent place. And what we're seeing gets back to The Cleaners, the documentary, that we're being fed a lie that the world is not violent, that it's getting better, that there's less violence, and yet it's not true. It's being cleaned by social media, by the news, by all these areas and ways of thinking that are contrary to the real. And I think that's a lot of the reason why people don't change, because they don't see it. It's like, no, that they live close to a rendering plant or slaughterhouse. They just see these nicely packaged meat products, and they think, what could be wrong? Look at it's all nicely done. I'm not a product of violence. Yeah, meat might be bad for you, but you know, everybody has to die. But they're not aware, because everything is becoming sanitized. Sanitized not in the right way, but in a hidden way. Anyway,
me respond to that right away. Sanitizing. Now, sanitizing is a really important concept. So let's help our listeners here to reflect on it even more. It's super important. So sanitizing means getting rid of those distasteful elements of reality. But that doesn't mean they're gone. It means sanitizing our perception. Here's another one. Think of the word homogeneity or homologous. You can create an objectifying system of government in which you create homologues. In other words, where you start making people believe that they're more similar than not, that they want the same things. You see what I'm getting at? They want the same things. And you can have a media barrage that tells people what they should want. And when you have a confused and anxious population, they will eat that up, like you can't believe, like what they should be doing, how they should be living their lives. And we have that right now. So homologous and sanitization. And so you've got people living these bourgeois lives with their 401ks and their houses and their green grass and their vacations and the books they read and the New York Times. What a bunch of drivel. All of that. And what it does is it keeps people in stasis. And when you keep people in stasis, they don't speak out. And it also it has an effect on the body, has an effect on the mind, which has an effect on the brain, which has an effect on the body. It's another part of a strategy to perpetrate a narcotic on the population. Lots of ways to perpetrate narcotics. You know, certainly one of the ways is through big pharma. You want to keep your population largely inebriated or drugged. And we've duped even, highly educated people into believing that pharmacology is somehow good for them, that they should be taking anti-anxieties, antidepressant drugs, when in reality they don't need them. There are many other strategies. So we keep people drugged, and therefore we can manage them. And then number two, we control their thinking through the media and through the things that we make sure they read. So now we've created personal identity structures. So let's loop back, Nazarita. And obviously there's more to say about these things, but let's loop back. So that's what we're talking about with transcendental closure. You have people whose very mind space or their noospheric dimension is compromised. It's completely closed. They don't want to change. they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear what you're talking about, rendering plants and slaughter plants and all the violence done to girls and boys and domestic dogs and cats and horses and exotic wildlife like grizzlies and wolves, tigers, lions, all the products that we make with fur or animal skins. People don't want to hear it. And it is so, creates so much cognitive dissonance when people do hear the truth, they don't accept it. They don't even want to experiment it, explore it. So that goes back to your query and your comment about the real. So let's talk about the real. How do we get people to wake up? What can we do?
Well, you know, recently, I just saw, I can't remember where it was, but someone says, we are the change. We are. The more that we think this, the more that we act, the more people recognize it. It's like when people come out of a stupor. If nobody says anything around them, they begin to think that their experience of waking up out of a stupor was fake, and they go back to the unreal. But the more people express and really work on themselves, become more open to see what is real, then the more they influence others. I think of it kind of like a ripple, and pretty soon it becomes a tsunami. And that is the key. It isn't so much how can I make that person change. It's like, am I doing enough in myself so that they see a change and they want that change? Do they recognize it? And I think, you know, my whole attitude is if someone refuses to recognize it, you know, there's many more people who want that change. And if we want to spend the rest of our lives trying to change one person instead of helping those who want to change, that's the key. I mean, you know, you can pound someone, you know, on the head trying to get them to change. And if they don't want to change, they can't. They don't want to. But there are many people who want to change, who have these stirrings that something is wrong. Something is wrong in the way that we're living, the way that we're being, the way that we live in our houses, the way that we interact with a non-human other, the way that we, you know, control or semi-control the earth, you know, the way that we control others, the way that we think about owning other people and owning objects. I mean, there's something wrong with it. And there are lots of people who are waking up to that fact. And those are the people that are going to be the ones that we influence. The other people will eventually come along because they'll go with whatever's popular, right? And the more people that really wake up, they'll come along.
That's right. That's right. So then you have these forces right now who are apparently or ostensibly benefiting from the system. And I remember a lecture series we participated in recently. One of the speakers said something that I agree with. And it's part of what came from Karl Marx's theories about the self. Remember, he wasn't just a brilliant economist and political theorist. He was also a great psychologist. And Marx had this notion that in a capitalist structure, the laborers were alienated from their being. And we know that because we've been talking about it for years. How everybody is so alienated from the earth and alienated from themselves and alienated from their reality principle. But also true that those people who ostensibly benefit from capitalism are also alienated. And this is this demands more explanation and exploration. People who are doing well as middle class and upper middle class bourgeoisie, they've got enough food to eat, they've got bigger houses and vacations. They have some kind of social status. They don't understand that that's also alienating them from their species being. So take a worker who works the land, who grows crops, and picks the crops, cleans the crops, cooks the crops for the rich. Now, the rich don't have that experience of living with the land and on the land. Something missing. Just like people go to restaurants and they get served dead, rotting carcasses of murdered animals. And it's all prettied up with vegetables and sauces, right? Nice plates, nice silverware, yeah. Nice linen. And you go in and there's this, and then nice wine. And it's all this big, believe it or not, it's a big deception.
It's a big deception.
So, and we have the same kind of deception in the grocery store. When people go to the meat counter and they want to go buy hamburger or hot dogs or chicken, and they even have chicken wrappings that portray chickens as being happy, that they're somehow happy to be slaughtered. And we inject red dye into red meat and hamburger. Most people are too stupid to even get that. There are antibiotics and hormones that are constantly injected into these poor, miserable, suffering animals that end up in the meat section of the grocery store. And we have these nice, neat little packages. And people don't understand that those packages represent murder, misery, and torture, and the rape of these animals' bodies to be constantly injected that with antibiotics, because if they didn't, they'd all be sick. And now we're seeing that super dangerous viruses are coming out of farmed animals for all sorts of scientific reasons. But this goes back to the reality principle. And you can have, Nazarita, on the one hand, a person who will say, oh, it's a shame that animals suffer. And then the next day, for July 4th, they'll go to the grocery store and they'll buy meat and they'll buy cheese. And they know goddamn well that it represents suffering. They'll put that piece of cheese in their mouth, or they'll eat yogurt. And it pisses me off because there are a lot of so-called feminist women who eat yogurt on the backs of starving, miserable, tortured, murdered female cows. They're not feminists. They're liars and they're cheaters. And their arguments can easily be overcome and destroyed. But the same thing about people buying these images, the Kardashian phenomenon. Little girls want to change the jaw structure in their face now. A lot of Asians do this. They're getting implants in their faces to change their faces and their skin and these this whole makeup protocol that makes people appear to be other than what they are. Because that's somehow a value. And the same with men. Men are not immune to this either. And here's another example. We perpetrated, I grew up in this, perpetrated the idea that a big, strong male athlete needed to eat tons of meat. And boy, did we. Steaks, chickens, pounding this antibiotic-laden food into our bodies. And now, bless them, these smarter athletes are figuring out that they can run faster and lift more weight by eating plants. And just like the strongest man competition, the strongest man in the world points out that the strongest animals in the world are herbivores. The rhino, the hippo, they don't eat meat. And so there's another lie. So I want to go back to what you're saying about, again, the reality principle. People are lied to, and they fall right into it. The question I have for you in our remaining 4 minutes is, how do we trigger a person's self-system so that they can become awake, exercise the will, and say no. Say no to the deception. Say no to the madness. What do we have to do to trigger people? What do you think?
Well, I think of myself. I had to learn to trust my inner thinking. I had to learn to do that in the face of everybody else thinking differently. And you brought up an interesting point where you said, you know, people go in, you know, there's these beautiful tablecloths, beautiful setting, everybody's eating meat. And if you don't, you're kind of like an outcast. It gets to the heart of how we want to be accepted. We want to be accepted. We want to be part of everybody. We want that belonging, that sense of belonging. And yet, that belonging is an illusion. Because otherwise you're commodified and homogenized. So I think the first is to discern what it is you really think. And I'm always asking myself that question, not what someone else thinks, but what do I think? Like, what do I really think? And I used to follow someone, Sam Keeney wrote a book, which you and I have talked about, your mythic image or something, like it was very similar to that. But it was questioning, why do you think these things? Who told you those things? Do you really believe them? Is it something that you think? And I often follow this, and I think that's kind of the first step. Does the emperor have clothes? If the emperor doesn't have clothes, and yet everybody around you says that he does, you have to look and say, who am I going to believe? Am I going to believe that I'm crazy, the only one here that believes that he's naked? Or am I going to go along with everybody? Because I think if you really go along, eventually you're going to find out that you were right, and it's gonna be really hard to accept that you didn't trust yourself and trust what is right. Meat isn't right. If everybody really looks at it, why do they eat meat? Because everybody else eats it. You grew up with it. Whatever. It doesn't mean that it tastes good, because if you really look at chewing meat for a long period of time, it tastes like sawdust. That can't be appealing. It isn't. Like, let's be real, right?
And people also
there you go.
People also discount the consequences of these behaviors, like eating meat and dairy. They don't want to look at the science. It's obvious that it's harmful. Not just because I'm saying it. There are hundreds of thousands of reports now that the factory farming ruins land, it toxifies water, it contributes to global warming, it's creating deforestation, which means we're eradicating species, potential plant remedies for disease down in the Amazon. You know, once you eradicate some resources, you will never get them back. So we're out of time today. We're going to come back next week. We're going to keep at it, keep chipping away at it. We want to wish everybody happy day. Courage. Courage today. Courage. Courage to see the truth and then to act appropriately. Thank you to Nazarita Goldhammer. Thank you to everybody on our staff, Epis Institute. And we wish you all a good week. We'll be back next week. This is Epis Radio signing out and saying goodbye.